You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft.
Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
I grew up with five generations under one roof.
Wow.
And so there was a lot of grown-ups around, and I was just sitting and listening to them.
Yeah.
And I think of podcasts that way. It's like you get to be the fly on the wall in the grown folks' conversations from all over the world. You could be that little kid in any community you want to be and just listening in.
Isn't that wonderful? It's also interesting in this pandemic that, you know, there was such a lot of understandably, desire at the beginning of it from the theater community to put stuff out there. You know, we all had to suddenly be doing readings, and we all had to be doing, you know, whatever. But the thing of all of these things that's gained in popularity is the podcast. I mean, people are wanting to sit and listen. They're not wanting to watch any. I mean, I find that really fascinating and very hopeful. Very hopeful.
And we hadn't been listening anymore because everything has been sound bites.
That's correct.
You know, every interview is a sound bite, and every show you get the same set of sound bites over and over and over again.
That's correct.
And in the course of an hour, you know, you run out of sound bites.
That's
you finally have to say something you haven't said before.
That's right. I remember doing, I think it was when we were doing Sweeney Todd on Broadway, and David Loud, who I think would have been in Merrily We Roll Along with
me. He was.
David was the musical director, and one day somebody asked him something about me, and he said, oh, John doesn't speak in thoughts or even sentences. He speaks in paragraphs. And what his meaning was, unafraid of words, right? You know, like not wanting to do, you know, we listen to sentences now as people who love words, because why would we be in the theater? And they're not even complete sentences anymore. People don't even finish their thoughts anymore.
Mm.
And as people, and you must have seen this with actors on stage with you, what's happened is that instead of people listening to each other, they're thinking, what can I say next?
Mm-hmm.
If you just listen, you'll know what to say next. And I'm sure you've sat opposite an actor on stage and thought, you're not listening to a word that's coming out of my mouth because you're busy thinking about your next intention. And there's a sadness in that too, that we're not listening to each other enough. But maybe the one of the good things of this time is that we'll regain some of that.
Maybe so. I also say that when you're working with an actor who is that present with you and listening and responding, for me as an actor, they give me my performance. Yes. I just put my attention on them, and just being with them, the performance is happening. I'm with them.
Right. That is what acting is. It is about listening and responding. Exactly. It's so. I love what Judi Dench says, that the hardest thing about acting is to realize how easy it is. And she doesn't mean simple. She means, you know, that it's natural to us all the time. We just have to make more greater access to ourselves in that, the greater vulnerability of ourselves. People are afraid of their vulnerability.
Well, it's kind of trained out of us. I'm reading this book, Sand Talk, and he's talking about how kids learn so much in the first 6 years because they're curious and they're da-da-da-da, and then we put them in a school And they're in an institution that trains all of that curiosity out of them.
Yeah. But when you, let me ask you, Tanya, when you trained as an actor in this country, when you were learning, well, you're still learning, but when you were actually going through your training, did they want you to really be a white actor? I mean, were they taking the blackness out of you?
I am so fortunate that my first professional acting class, I was 15 years old, and William H. Macy was my teacher. And the St. Nicholas Theater, they were developing their version of Meisner's technique. So I was the only, I was a young person. John Mahoney was 45. It was his acting class. I was training with adults. And so they were just training me like another actor in the room. And what I remember most about it, because after I did the adult class, I did a summer with the teens. And they would always put me with the person who had something obviously wrong with them, because they knew I had been trained enough that I was going to tell the truth, that all the other actors were going to be polite. And I was, you know, you got a big mole on your nose. The repetition, you got to say what you see. You know, I got a big mole on my nose. And I had gotten comfortable enough with the discomfort of other people that it made for good acting from even those other people. Because when no one's being honest with them, then they're sitting in the tension of, I know they're thinking it, I know they're feeling it. And so it's just a fake thing for everybody.
Sure. Mind you, you've never been afraid of telling the truth.
I don't know that that's true, but I think that because I grew up with a mother who was, I didn't know at the time, mentally ill, having to hold on to my truth was critical to my sanity. So if I was in spaces and people were saying something that did not match my reality, I had to call it out, because then if it's, whoa, I don't know what reality is. So
then there's madness.
It definitely was about holding on to reality. Like, I don't know what y'all talking about. I missed that.
Yeah. Got it. Interesting. Yes, my father was an alcoholic, and a dear man, but things could get very, very out of control, and I would take control of the family. I was an only child, and I would take control of them and parent them, really, and in so many ways, I'm so grateful, because that gave me my job. I mean, that gave me the training to be the daddy in the room. Now, I've spent my career trying to let go of being the daddy in the room in order to let everybody else into the room. That's a life journey. But it was really very interesting. I think also being an only child, you know, we had because I come from the Highlands of Scotland, it can be very cold. And there was a sandbox in the corner of the room where the children could go in and play in it as little children, because it was too cold to go out to the yard to play. I never, ever wanted to go into the sandbox, but I always wanted to help the other children to climb into it. It's exactly what I've done for a living.
Now, exactly. Is that because you don't like to get dirty?
No, it was because I, at that point in my life, didn't really know how to play, being an only child. And also, I was the eldest of 17 cousins, and we all lived within three streets of each other. And I was like 7 years older than any of them. You know, there was a seven-year gap after me. So I kind of looked after all of them, and I took care of their playing, and I taught some of them how to read. And I was the big brother, if you like, but big cousin to all of them. So I didn't allow myself the playing. And even I have some little black and white photographs of myself as a child with other cousins and children on the beach. And they're all in one part of the photograph building a sandcastle. And I'm over here on the way to the right of them building my own sandcastle. So it was in me from the beginning to be on the outside looking
Did you
in.
Get to, like, for me, because I'm also the oldest of all the cousins, because my mother had me when she was 14. So her brothers and sisters had to grow up and become adults before they had kids. So I'm also older. But that also meant that when they were playing cards and they needed a fourth, I, you know, at 8 years old, I'm the fourth. So I was doing all these, playing these games with them. Did you have stuff like that?
Sure. Yes, I did. I was, and I was always with the grown-ups. And I was able, from a very small age, to have, I hope not pretentious ones or inappropriate ones, but to have grown-up conversations. I always was. And I never found it frightening to talk in public or anything like that. I was always able, and very comfortable with, almost, I mean, none of them were, they certainly none of them were intellectuals, but comfortable with having difficult conversations with them. You know, I had a very powerful grandmother. I mean, not, I say powerful, she was very important in my life and always listened to me. Maybe because she knew I was wasn't always being listened to, and in a very caring way. And I still think of her a lot. I learned a lot from her ability to listen.
Now, you said that the Scots were shipped off away from the Highlands. So how'd your family get back?
Well, the Scottish part of my family didn't leave. But my name, of course, is Irish. Doyle is an Irish name. It's the name of the Irish Parliament. And the Doyle. And my great-grandfather on my father's side of the family was the youngest. He was the youngest of 14 children, so that can tell you which side of the church they were on. And he was from County Wicklow in the south of Ireland, which is incredibly beautiful. And he ran away to sea as a stowaway on a ship when he was 11. Never went back to Ireland. I know. But you know, the people were running away from poverty, weren't they? I mean, and if your parents couldn't afford to bring you up, your auntie brought you up or something. And so he ran away, never went back. And that was the beginning of the Doyle side of the family in Scotland. My mother's side of the family actually come from Norway. So they came in through the very top of Scotland, through Caithness, which is the most northerly county of Scotland. They came in from there. So I'm a very interesting Celtic mix. It's not only Scots, you know, it's kind of the Northlands.
But it's Northlands by lived Northlands. Like the Native Americans often say, the bloodline doesn't really matter to be indigenous. It's lived experience. So you're Scots lived experience because you've got the Norway blood and the Irish blood coming to Scotland and having lived experience of that culture.
That's correct. And an experience of living in an environment that was you know, you've been there. It's extraordinarily beautiful. And I didn't know that at the time. I mean, I couldn't wait to get out, of course. But I go home now, and that's home. And not all of Scotland, not Glasgow, not Edinburgh, but that bit up there amongst the mountains and the lochs, the lakes, it's so in my soul. It's so home to me. And it's very interesting that the nature of the circle and the nature of the figure of eight are part of our dancing, right? The figure of eight reflects water, of course, you know, the water movement. And the whole Celtic notion of in my beginning is my end. You know, you end where you began. Mm-hmm. It's cyclical, right? Stone circles that we have up there. Now, my staging of my work is always cyclical. If you were in a play for me, you would find that you were walking in a figure of eight shape to get to the next place, not in a straight line. And you would find that the image that I start with is usually the image that I end with. And so there's something Scottish in my work. And an audience isn't going to know that. They're not going to understand that. But they may be able to relate to spirituality.
Is it a choice you made, or is it a discovery you made? You discovered that about yourself.
No, it's not a choice. Absolutely. I learned that about myself over time. It took me a long time. You know, I was, as I said to you, you know, I was a sort of journeyman jobbing director for a long time. And actually, it was a production of, I did a production of Sweeney Todd, not the one that became known here, but one that done the normal way, you know, a small scale version of Hal Prince's original production. And having done it, I felt depressed. I am not somebody who feels depressed. I don't, or if I ever do, I'm perfectly okay about it. But I didn't feel good. And I thought, why am I not feeling good? And I realized that what I'd done was copy. You know, there was a barber's chair up above, and there was a shoot that people came down when their throats were cut. And Mrs. Lovett had a little red wig like Angela Lansbury. And, you know, it's a copy. It's perfectly good. But it was, and I thought, I don't want to do this. I don't want to copy Hal Prince. Hal Prince has the right to be himself. You know, Hal Prince was his own genius. And I'd never up to that point been able to call myself an artist. I called myself a director. But the word artist embarrassed me. Now, that's a very Presbyterian thing. And I started almost after 20 years of directing shows and plays, I went back to the beginning. I spent a little bit of time in Moscow at the Moscow Art Theatre. And I really took time to look at my work and to look at what I was trying to say with my work. Not just putting things on, not just putting it up there, but what was I trying to say? And that led to my demand always for longer rehearsal periods than I used to have, for collaborations in the room that were challenging to me as well as making me feel comfortable, all sorts of things. And that was the beginning of the second half of my career. And at that point, I could start calling myself an artist. I saw that, oh, no, your need to begin and end that way is okay. It's not wrong. It's who you are. And bring yourself to the storytelling. Always remembering as a director that you were telling somebody else's story. When I did The Color Purple, my job, my primary job was to honor Alice Walker, right? That's why I was in the room. If I could help everybody else to honor their parts of themselves that led to the communal honoring of Alice Walker, then that's wonderful. And I think that's probably what happened. But I could only do that by being me.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
It's interesting because when you talk about copying, I feel like so much of my singing, most of my career was copying. And I also did not like to have to sing if I wasn't a character. Uh-huh. I didn't like to do benefits and cabarets and things because for me, singing is so naked and vulnerable that I actually don't even do it much anymore because I only kind of can enjoy it privately when I'm safe enough to just let whatever's going to happen happen and can be with that. And so much of what I see in the world that people are applauding about singing can be, I don't even know what it is, but it doesn't, it just feels like a circus, a circus thing. And I'm like, I don't do the circus thing. So what I do isn't going to be valued. So I just rather not do anything.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think that also comes to, so as you're talking there, it makes me think about, you know, a realization that I had that I say to actors all the time is that you are enough. You don't have to be somebody else. You don't have to sing like Cleo Lane, you know, or whatever it is. I don't have to direct like Hal Prince or Peter Brook or whoever else my heroes are. I can only be John Doyle. You can only be Tonya Pinkins. And we are enough. In fact, we're probably too much. So, you know.
Yeah, kids just don't believe it. I mean, I had a student calling me the other day and they want to know, what is it? What do I have to be? What do I have to do? What's the secret? I mean, I remember being that young and just trying to figure out, what is it they're looking for? How can I be it? What's the hair? What's the dress? What's the, you know, capitalism feeds that.
Capitalism feeds that. I mean, the question that actors will say all the time about, oh, what do they want? Honey, the realization is they probably don't know what they want. So you have to let them know that you are what they want. You're enough for them. That's a big hurdle, and it's a particular hurdle in a prize-giving society where, as you know, I mean, we can look at, you know, I'm older than you, but we can look at our careers and realize that we're still learning and that we've done enough to be deemed successful, whatever that means. But for so many young actors, their thinking is, if they haven't made it in the first year, they're dumped. I was with a big London agent who, he came to see a show of mine one night. We went out for a cocktail and we were talking. And I said, how do you nurture your young actors? And he said, if they haven't made it within the first 6 months, we dump them. And I said, well, you know what? You just dumped me because I'm dumping you, because I don't want to be in the same space as somebody who does that to other human beings. Somebody famous. This was a big old agent. I thought, no. We shouldn't be doing that to each other. People can grow in all sorts. Some plants take many more years to grow than others, and they can then be with us for hundreds of years. That's fine. But I think there's a real sadness in, you know, if I haven't won my Oscar by the time I'm 24, I'm done. I'm sorry. No.
And then I say to them, and what are you going to do with the rest of your life?
Yes.
Okay. You got the Oscar 24. Now you got 50 more years to live. What are you going to do?
Yeah. And you know, all those television programs with sort of, you know, I don't know, The Voice or whatever all those things are. I mean, I don't watch any of them.
I don't either. But
all that notion of, you know, public auditioning, what's all that about? And also, there's no value. It's almost like there's no value in being trained anymore.
Right. And I know some of the producers and the music people and the backup singers on their shows, and this is what they told me. The best people never get chosen to be on the show, because they have to make a narrative arc for a season. And if there's anybody who's really good, it would mess up the story.
Isn't that tragic?
So you got people feeling like, I didn't make it on The Voice. I suck. And actually, you were too good.
You were too good. And also, look, the casting and stuff that goes on nowadays around, I've been in rooms with producers who will say, oh, well, you know, they've got a million followers, so we better book them. And I'm saying, what does following mean? I don't do social media, so I don't even know what you're talking about. When I'm not having somebody in the rehearsal room because they have followers. I mean, please. But that's what we're doing. That's what we're doing to our profession. And we have to be, people like you and me have to shout and holler and stop it from happening, because it's going to stop craft. And it's going to stop class, and that would be very sad.
It has been so lovely talking to you. I could talk to you forever.
I could talk to you all evening.
Yes, we'll have to have tea again. My last question to you. I'm you know, it's September, which is the Scorpio, which is, you know, we're at the point where I contemplate my mortality on a daily basis, because I feel like the next moment is never promised to any of us. And most people don't want to live with the knowing, but I do. I think about what today, what do I need to do? Because the next moment's not promised. Yeah. If you don't, you know, what's left that you want to do before you go?
Well, complicated answer to your question. You said you're a Scorpio?
No. This is the month of Scorpio. I'm a Gemini. Month but this Scorpio, Scorpio which is, you know, you contemplate death. That's what the Scorpion is. So.
Okay. Yes. My star sign is Scorpio. Oh, okay. I had an interesting experience that happened to me 5 years ago now. I have a relatively controllable heart condition, but I was misdiagnosed with a medication that slowed my heart down too much. And I came into John F. Kennedy Airport, and my husband was with me. He would testify, and I dropped dead. And I actually died 4 times in 6 seconds. And I have no worry about telling you this because I think it's important to share these things. And I was very lucky that I was at the airport, and they are, of course, trained in CPR. So they were able to keep me alive. And they took me to the hospital there. I've forgotten the name of it at this moment in time. And for 4 days of my life, I was not with the world. I woke up there 4 days later. I'd been on life support. And they took me off life support. They thought I would be mentally damaged because my head hit the marble of the airport floor. And also, I had been without oxygen for up to half an hour in totality. As you can tell, I'm perfectly okay.
This is the
okay.
brain damage, John Doyle, we've been getting all these years doing this brilliant work.
Can you imagine what the other version was like? So I woke up in the hospital in Queens, and I was told that I had not been with the world for a period of time, and they were completely shocked that I was still alive when I woke up, and it made me change everything about my life. It made me value my life in an entirely different way, because I can tell you that I didn't see a long tunnel with light at the end. But whatever happened, it was okay, right? Even if it was nothing, it was okay. And I didn't know about it. And there's an enormous gift in that. Now, my mortality time change didn't come with pain. So I was very fortunate. And I realized the reality of it hit me one day when I had to go to my cardiologist and he had to sign in a form and it said cardiac death. And I thought, oh my God, I've heard of cardiac arrest, but death? And he said, what happened? I said, okay. And it made me realize that I love being in a rehearsal room, but it would be okay if I was never in one again. I love actors, and yet it would be okay if I never directed another one. I adore telling stories, Tonya. As you can probably tell just the way we're speaking, I'm a natural storyteller. I love to tell stories. But it would be okay if I didn't ever tell another one, because then I don't need another prize. So you asked me, what would I do? I would like to keep working. I'd like to do less. I'd like to take less responsibility in that environment. I'd like to take more time to be responsible for my family and the rest of my life, you know, because that's always challenging. But as long as whatever I do has got beautiful words, I'll be happy. I don't want to do stories that aren't well written. You know, I've been lucky. I've worked with Steve Sondheim, Terrence McNally, you know, John Kander. I mean, I'm a very fortunate man, and I've been in the room with remarkable people. But I want to only do good words, because I do believe that words are precious. And I I love the Solzhenitsyn, when he won his Nobel Peace Prize, at the end of his speech, it says, "One word of truth can change the whole world." And I believe that our art form can be part of that truth, because we've been told an awful lot of lies of late, and it's time for more truth. And if I can be any part of that truth telling, I'll be a happy man for the next time I die.
Thank you, John Doyle. This is Tanya Pinkins. You're listening to You Can't Say That on the Broadway Podcast Network.
Thanks for listening to You Can't Say That, the show where you can. I'm Tanya Pinkins, and You Can't Say That is part of the Broadway Podcast Network, produced by Dori Berenstein and Alan Seals, edited by Derek Gunther, with music by Kat Dale. If you like what you hear, don't forget to subscribe and rate this podcast highly wherever you stream. Follow me on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Tanya Pinkins. And to learn more, visit bpn.fm/YCST. Stay safe.
You is kind. You is smart. You is important. You is dead. Tanya Pinkin's horror film, Red Pill, brings African-American perspective to progressive movement.
We are a majority in this country, and we're going to win the election.
Do you know what the red pill is? A red pill is someone who infiltrates a group and then destroys them from the inside. This place is spooky.
Some people like to live dangerously.
Cass, why are you so jumpy tonight?
You know what, guys? I'm gonna go back tomorrow.
Did you hear about the creature woman that attacked a father and son hunting down here?
I don't see the case. This place creeps me out.
I think we should call the sheriff's office.
The only people missing or dead are brown people.
They're after all of us.
What do we do, Amelia?
We die. But we take some of them with us.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.